All right, so in this pitch talk, I would like to tell you something about recent work that Jaroslav and myself were involved in, and it has to do with dynamic magnetoelectric effect in ferromagnetic superconductor tunnel junctions. So it's a ferromagnet separated by a thin insulator barrier from a usual S-wave superconductor. So, okay, so to go a bit into the motivation, why we started looking at that is because there were some, back in 2008, there were like some experiments showing that if you have some ferromagnet here and you start precessing it, and here was a normal metal, and if you put a tunnel barrier between the two, and you start precessing the ferromagnet by driving it with microwaves, then you see that the tunnel barrier, so if you have a tunnel barrier, enhances voltage build up in the system compared to just ohmic kind of contact. So tunnel barriers enhances magnetization dynamics induced voltages. So that was one important aspect.
Voltage between where and where?
Well, voltage between here and here. So you make a circuit now between these two. You collect the voltage. And that was much larger than what usually explained with just spin pumping. So then some other new mechanisms were needed to explain this kind of effect. So in these two papers, it was approached in a different, the effect was approached differently. So what here is just a sketch. Well, it's not really what this experiment was. This was like a ferromagnet insulator normal, but here is more like a ferromagnet insulator ferromagnet. And what they, in this kind of setup, what they looked at, it's the voltage build up, not due to spin pumping, but due to charge pumping induced by the magnetization dynamics. So what happens, so briefly, what exactly happens, so physically what happens is that if now you drive this magnet here, and you have the spins here follow this magnetization dynamics, and you could see this magnetization, time-dependent magnetization as a time-dependent magnetic field that induces some spin bias in the system. So you could see that effect as a Berry phase kind of effect, and spin up and spin down, they acquire different Berry phases, and then that kind of Berry phase was shown to induce some voltage in the system that doesn't have to, that doesn't depend on the tunneling strength at all. However, what it was found here that the voltage that one induces in such a setup, so it's rather small. Well, it's still proportional to omega. That's the driving frequency here. That's the polarization, so of the ferromagnets here assumed to be the same. And the theta is the cone angle, so the precession angle. So what you can see is that if you have small precession, that, of course, voltage is rather small. So if it is like five degrees, that already reduces a lot compared to the bare omega. So you need very good detection in order to.
Which way is it different from spin pumping?
Well, it's kind. Well, that's more like charge pumping instead of spin pumping, but they are kind of the same.
The charge pumping because it pumps into a ferromagnet.
It pumps into a ferromagnet. Yeah. Otherwise, there is nothing. So if you put a if I put a normal metal, there is nothing there. So that's
It's really charge pumping. Yeah. For example, you could crank up spin relaxation, and it doesn't change the result.
Yeah.
Like in the Bartlett Bass type of experiment that preceded this experiment, it was really spin pumping and followed by some kind of spin diffusion and back action. And there, if you crank up spin relaxation, the signal should go away. And you see that it's really spin pumping.
In the normal, this is zero. Yeah. And this is zero in the normal. Yeah.
It's really charge pumping. You have this magnetic dynamics that modulates matrix elements across the tunnel junction. You pump charge directly. You don't have to make. Here, we assume actually spin relaxation is fast enough, such that you don't worry about spin.
So theoretically, like the equation, like the approach more or less the same, right?
Or I mean, it's still adiabatic pumping, if you
It's not the same and so far there's no mixing contact.
Right.
Right.
It's really just spin-dependent tunneling.
Mm-hmm. All right, so that was the setup and the voltage, it goes like theta squared here. So it's kind of small if you look in realistic situations like here. But still, it's much larger than what you get from spin pumping. If you assume spin pumping here, effect, and put tunnel barrier, and do all these spin accumulation and that transfer into a voltage, that's not, doesn't explain.
You get zero for spin problem?
I think not still, exactly. Not exact, but I think it doesn't explain the large, I think it's, okay, that's what you've done also. Like you looked at spin pumping part.
By Bartlett Bayes. And it's like this single ferromagnet tremolo and then a platinum contact, an aluminum contact. Mm-hmm. And then as you excite the dynamics in the ferromagnet, you develop voltage between platinum and aluminum.
Okay.
As a result of, then you know, in platinum you spin pump and then it relaxes very quickly. In aluminum you spin pump and there's some kind of backflow and then there's also diffusion equations. But you really need ohmic interfaces for that spin pumping to induce any voltage. And it was time, it was 100 nanovolt. The moment you put tunnel barriers there, they kill spin pumping. And the spin relaxation, any, you know, tiny spin relaxation kills it. So it's exponentially small. It's not like it's zero, but it's actually tiny.
But you have an explanation for that experiment, right?
Yeah.
No, you're cool also there, so.
We had a speculation. I don't know what that is. You know, so they also had some follow-up experiments with two ferromagnets, like on the picture to the right, which we had like great, then everything is very easy to understand. If you replace one ferromagnet with normal metal, they already see some signal. And that we can speculate about what's going on, but it's very difficult to come up with a clear-cut picture. But you could speculate about it. It's not like crazy, but you know, it's not as unambiguous as this kind of spin-off case.
Yeah.
So these driving frequencies are small. I mean, this result is based on derivative.
It's microwave. It's microwave. It's small compared to exchange splitting. All right. So we, wanted to see if there are some systems which, you know, you have this sine of theta dependence here that kind of give you a hard time really using this kind of setup to detect. I mean, of course, it still enhances, but it's kind of bad because theta is small. So can you imagine something that would give you a better resolution of this magnetization dynamics conversion into voltage? So what we looked at, and I will show you later why we looked at, at a junction that consists of a ferromagnet here, again at a tunnel junction, and a superconductor here. So here we have again magnetization dynamics. Okay, this picture is a rotating frame. I will probably tell later more about it. So if you go in the rotating frame, you get some fictitious splittings here that can cause some currents flowing through the system. Also here we have the superconductor for spin up, spin down. Here we have the singular density of states. Here is the superconducting gap, and here it's the fictitious splitting, the rotating frame. But what's important here that you have a gap here. So density of states is very singular. So that's kind of the Hamiltonian that will describe such a structure. This is the exchange splitting in the ferromagnet. This is the superconducting gap in the superconductor. Well, sigma here stands for spin, and this for the NAMBU space. So of course, then why is the superconducting special? That's the question. And OK, I already said something about the rotating frame, but one can really see that if you really perform it and analyze it. So what we do, we start analyzing this transfer property in the rotating frame, where everything becomes rather static, at least if you don't have any spin orbit or you have a good axis around which you can perform this rotating frame rotation. So if you then what you end up is that this Hamiltonian is transformed to this Hamiltonian. So we have also this kind of gauge field here, and we get this fictitious splitting. We can go step by step. We can go to the left and see what happens in the ferromagnet. So the ferromagnet is transformed to this, and that's we don't get the full omega sigma z because of the strong exchange splitting. So we only get the projection along the the initial magnetization. And we also get a splitting here in the ferromagnet omega cosine theta, and the spins are tilted. In the superconductor, you don't suffer of that large exchange splitting, so the spins they can just follow the rotation. And what you end up is with this fictitious magnetic field and with the density of states now that become spin dependent. So that's what happens in the ferromagnet. That's what happened in the superconductor. And that's where everything is like hidden. So that's like the superconductor acquires this spin-dependent density of states.
Sorry.
Yeah.
So superconductor. This is S-wave superconductor.
It is S-wave superconductor.
So does this like fictitious magnetic field somehow make superconductivity unstable?
No, no. It's just a fictitious. Nothing really. It doesn't break anything. That's on the quasi-particles anyway. So it's, first of all, it's fictitious, so it will not, it doesn't equilibrate or anything. So you can.
As long as tunneling is weak.
Right,
so
then you have to, right. If you go beyond, then you have to do self-consistently and see what's the new ground state. Well, how is the new state of the superconductor looking like? But here, it's just fictitious, so it's nothing actually really is changed. All right, so then what one does starts building up some transport here between the ferromagnet and superconductor. And well, just in the tunneling approximation, that's the Hamiltonian that couples the ferromagnet and the superconductor. And within the Fermi's golden rule, we can look at the transport. And the transport looks as simple as that. But the only, there are a couple of issues here. So the spin in the superconductor and the ferromagnet, of course, are tilted from each other, so you get some dependence in the tunneling matrix elements on this angle. So that's one important aspect. And why? Okay. Then we analyze that current. Okay, you get some expression for the current. And let me just tell you more about what we consider here. So first of all, we consider no Andreev processes. So we really look at quasi-particle transport through this structure. We also don't consider any multi-magnon processes. If you drive hard and hard, probably all this rotative approximation kind of breaks down, and you can excite different kind of magnons. And also what we get by just looking at this expression, there is no current for delta S, if frequency doesn't overcome the gap, so
it's
zero temperature. Yeah.
I'm somehow lost.
Yeah.
I mean, you assume that there is voltage.
Yeah.
Which is static.
Yeah.
And on top of that, where is the AC
component?
You just take AC component of the voltage, or just pull by hand?
Well, what I do by hand, I take the rotative approximation, and I want to see how the transport looks like in this.
No, that's okay, but so you put, what is rotating? So you just put by hand and the magnetization?
Magnetization is rotating.
Okay, and voltage is static.
It's static, yeah.
Voltage is developing in response to rotation. So let's assume it's open circuit.
Yeah. This is now open circuit. And then, of course, once you put closed, then at some point it builds up some polarization after some time, and the current should turn to.
So that V there is not an applied voltage?
No, it's not an applied voltage, but it's not an applied voltage.
But then once you go to the rotating frame, don't you get two voltages for two different spin projections?
Well, you just measure a big voltage. I mean, of course, in the end, you sum up all the processes. But once I sum up, I just look at the charge transport here. So I just get some voltage that I measure the ends.
But again, the assumption is in the tunneling regime, in the laboratory frame of reference, the spin relaxation is fast enough compared to the tunneling rate that the voltage is well defined in the laboratory frame.
Yeah, I'm just verified the fact that once you look, in the rotating frame, once you look at the superconductor,
then
you have splitting.
Which is exactly the point, yeah, right. That's kind of where things come from.
All right, so again, then you open the circuit and you measure the voltage, so you take that the current should be zero and want to see what voltage one measures. So then, okay, that's kind of a phase diagram if you want, in terms of omega, here the cone angle, and here the voltage that one induces.
In units of which moment?
In units, no, that's, okay, that's in units, everything is in units of the gap.
Okay.
So gap is the energy scale that everything is compared to.
don't heat Fermilab when you rotate magnetization?
No, the current, everything is really small. Like all these currents are really weak.
So the temperature gradient is negligible.
It's negligible in this.
Well, in this field.
Yeah.
If metal, of course.
Yeah, something. Yeah, problem.
Say how you rotate the.
Then once the frequency reaches this value, you start activating transport. Below this frequency, everything is blocked, and there is no transport occurring because the superconductor is like an insulator. Now what's important that...
let's see, so could you get cosine, which is minus 1? Yeah, well, at least it's on
yeah.
How does it correspond to the notion that you don't
have
below the gate?
No, it's more like modulus of, because, okay, so it's more like, it doesn't matter how, okay, if I put it down, so if I put cosine equal to minus 1, I have to redo the rotating wave.
So that's written only for positive cosine.
For positive, so it's theta is between 0 and pi over 2. Yeah.
Theta is the cone angle.
Yeah.
So that means cos of theta 1 would be just rotating in the plane.
Cos theta 1 being, no, it's cos theta 1 will be 0, right? Theta will be 0. That's kind of also the, you know, one of the highlights, if you want, that here, so theta is the cos, so,
okay,
yeah.
So usually, so in practice, theta will be very small.
Exactly. But what's important now, if you look at, you have here some activation depending on how you tune the frequency, and then you have several frequencies for spin up, spin down in the superconductor, and then you have different activation frequency depending how you match those levels. And then at some, so the maximum voltage that you can obtain, it's this. So it's this line here. So. And the maximum voltage that you can obtain from this magnetization dynamics, it turns out to be proportional to cosine theta, as opposed to the usual sine squared of theta, which looks like, okay, if I put theta to 0, make smaller and smaller, I could really make this VC1 equal to 1, which means omega is also of the order here of 1 or 2, and it means that VC1 will be of the order of the driving frequency.
But you're not generating any precession.
Yeah, I have to be careful. Just what you said now. Elaborate a little bit more. It's a very singular limit, right?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, that's okay.
If theta is exactly
yeah.
zero,
if theta exactly, yeah,
zero.
The answer is zero. So it's okay. If it's kind of a limit, but the limit theta equal to zero is bad. So you have to be careful. It's a singular limit. But as you put theta to very small, you get large voltage.
It's not non-tonic, right?
You'll see that when you put finite temperature, that will make it clear. But you cannot put this theta equal to zero. You can say theta is very small, and then you really have increase. But if you put theta theta to equal zero, that's a wrong answer. You cannot get something from.
Let's make one concrete statement that's useful here. So if theta is zero, pi or pi over two, the answer is zero. If theta is 0 pi, then you have no precession. And if theta is pi over 2,
right.
Actually, there are symmetries, you know, that basically tell you that it's 0.
And so this formula is only good away from the point specifically 0.
Sure. Once you turn temperature, it will, like, just a bit of temperature, it will tell you, kind of.
You have to also notice, it's not the voltage that you induce. This is some kind of critical voltage in this plot. But the voltage that you induce would actually be 0 for 0 theta.
Yeah, it will be 0, yeah, but you can't, like,
how much time do we have to talk, by the way? I was chair.
I'm moderating? Okay.
Well, you can take it out.
Okay.
But how much time do we have to talk?
So this talk's a half hour in total. Okay. Like 15 plus 15. 15 minutes without interruption.
We have 6 minutes.
Okay.
At some level, I don't care that you have a cosine.
Well,
because that's not the voltage that's induced.
No, it is. It's okay. That's the maximum voltage that you induce. It's where driving frequency is of the order of the gap. That's more or less what you need, which is microwave. I mean, it's true. that's the max. Okay, what I said. Okay, I kind of hidden things that that's the maximum voltage that you can induce. But the voltage, if you go away, that's the line for that volume. If you go away, it doesn't vary too much, so it still stays within the same ballpark.
Do you have on the, do you have on dimensional plots?
I have for finite temperature, but
let's go to those plots because this is maybe a little bit overwhelming at this point. Let's go to those one-dimensional plots.
Okay, so here it's, you know, at finite temperature. So then here, okay, that will be the zero temperature. That will be this maximum voltage that I was telling you about. And then you increase omega. So you have here still a wide range of frequencies compared to the gap, again, where voltage is more or less comparable to omega itself.
Even for tiny.
In my picture, everything should start from omega equal 1, right?
Right, yeah.
It starts somewhere on
finite temperature.
That's okay.
But even at finite temperature, you don't have anything below the gap.
You have some thermal excitations,
Do you mean it's just exponential?
No. It's actually
More
complicated than that.
Okay, this is.
This is on the current. The current would be some thermal activator. But here, you're asking what's the voltage that you would settle at in the in a steady state. So the current could be thermal activator, but the voltage that you induce could actually be algebraic.
Okay, so what's important that here, that over.
It would take a long, long time. Especially long time in principle to get to the steady state, but we don't worry about that.
Okay, the punchline here is that the voltage can be comparable to delta in the range where the frequency is comparable to the gap. And that's kind of the, and you don't suffer of this small theta angle. Of course, here I plot the voltage for some fixed frequency somewhere here. I sit here, and the function of theta. So that's kind of the unphysical result that if you go to theta equals 0, cosine theta equals 1, theta equals 0, that will be the unphysical. So here it will be like it goes and drops down. But for finite temperature, you already see here it just goes down. So everything becomes a 0.
But the point he made that it would take infinitely long to build up that voltage.
Oh, yeah, that's exactly. You have to wait forever. Yeah. So there's more of the angle, you just have to wait. So as I said, the finite temperature solves this. Otherwise, you just see this in a line here, but temperature.
Why do you say it's unphysical?
Well, it's okay, unphysical that you cannot really.
It's that one point.
Yeah, that one point here. You know, it has to be excluded somehow. You have this formula, and you say, at zero it's perfect, but it's not. That's kind of okay. Then you can look at different temperatures and. What's important, okay, I don't want to dwell too much on that, but what's important, first of all, the effect disappears when the gap closes because then the superconductor turns into a normal metal, and if you have ferromagnet insulated normal metal, this effect should give you zero, so that's true. It satisfies, you know, that condition if you want. But also, like for a wide range of temperature, still the voltage, you know, stays rather large and comparable to the frequency. So
how would these curves change if you said, okay, I have some time over which it's processing?
Well,
it becomes an issue at very low temperatures. Namely, the time it takes to accumulate voltage, it depends on tunnel barrier, then, right? And the strength of tunnel barrier. So it becomes an issue if you have very thick tunnel barrier and very low temperatures, then it lasts forever. To the gap voltage, basically in the experiment you may not get the point. But as long as temperature is not too small and tunneling is not too weak.
Well, also angle, that's,
an angle, you may get to these voltages perhaps pretty quickly.
Yeah. Maria, you have to allow for lots of time to build up. Okay, so just to put this now into kind of contrast the two pictures of why we actually looked at that. And if we have this ferromagnet insulated ferromagnet that I showed you in the beginning, as I said, the voltage here, it's like more or less theta squared. So for small cone angle, this is small. Here the voltage is cosine theta, again with that singular point, but you know, if you have some finite angle, theory stays rather large, so it can be really comparable to omega. Well, omega here is a bit hidden, but it's there. So that happens when omega is of the order of the superconducting gap anyway. So that's, and somehow it's natural because, you know, superconducting gaps are also of the order of microwaves, so they kind of live in the same energy scale regime. So that's kind of nice.
But it seems like the voltage doesn't have the units of energy on the right hand side.
No, okay, here I just took the four. Here, if you want, okay, this is, I take this V over omega, and then it's here it's
V over gap.
So, and gap, so everything happens around the gap, so the gap is more or less omega. So we have to find the right energy scale somehow. In this problem, that's the only energy scale you have. In this problem, you have the gap. So.
Very simply explain how you get this spin to charge conversion without spin orbit interaction.
Well, I think it's the same as in your case. I mean, you have different spin bias that you apply, and when you add this, you have some electromotive forces that build up due to this magnetization dynamics, and that will give you some voltage that builds up. It's
But implicitly, it has no interaction. Just assume spin relaxation is fast.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, again, this measurements, like Mark Jones type of measurements, when you have spin accumulation and with a ferromagnet of a tunnel barrier, you convert it directly into voltage by assuming that the spin relaxation is fast enough. Because, you know, with a tunnel barrier, it's never a concern.
But okay, but
these
2 minutes is easy to understand, right?
So
mm-hmm.
The superconductor acts like a magnet.
Like a magnet, yeah, okay, that's...
Superconductor in the is a strong magnet. That's basically the main message.
But with funny density of state.
Yeah, exactly, so that's...
Very
funny
density of state, but because, you know, when the frequency is kind of comparable to the gap, in the electron preference, superconductor actually becomes a very strong magnet. So that's why you get very strong voltages, and the singularity density of states also enhances it.
It's not only superconductor. You can take semiconductor also. It's just that the gaps are much larger usually than, you know, microwave. But whatever has a gap with some singularity, if you stay in that range, should give you the kind of the same. So that's kind of the idea behind using a superconductor. So these are kind of some comparison, and here is more like difference in the density of states, and it is singularity in the density of states in the superconductor, and both are kind of baryphase effects, if you want.
Do you have an AC signal or an DC
signal? I think you have, but what we didn't look at that. Yeah, it should be. Yeah.
Well, for a constant cone angle, it's basically DC.
Yeah.
So it's a bit different from spin bump.
What is more important, having gap or having a singularity? If, for example, you have a pseudo gap, or on one hand, or you have a whole singularity, it will not.
Yeah.
I think both are.
Yeah, both are important.
You
really somehow, yeah. Kind
of funny. You can have a gap, but you know, choose a density of states such that you have no effect. Mm-hmm. You kind of need feature-full density of states on the energy scale of the gap. Mm-hmm. Because in a sense, you know, you get some kind of instability in the equation, and then it's a matter of you get positive feedback and negative feedback. So positive feedback, then the voltage builds up, and then it's really details of the band structure on that energy scale. That
actually, okay, that's lies at the heart of this effect. If you want, the superconductor turns into a ferromagnet in the rotating frame, at least in that energy scale, and okay, that's kind of my conclusion and a bit of outlook. So that the magnetization dynamics looks in a voltage in this ferromagnet insulated superconductive structure, you can achieve maximum voltage of the same order with the frequency for small cone angles, which is kind of good. Use this as a, if you want, as a local magnetization dynamic probe, so you can come with superconducting tip, well, in principle, and check like local environments, local magnetization dynamics. And that's another thing. You can go the other way around and say, well, magnetization dynamics can really probably probe density of state. So maybe you can put nearby a non-conventional superconductor and see, for example, if you get something, some answers regarding that density of states. And the spectrum in the superconductor by looking at by putting an adjacent ferromagnet and look at the voltage. And
what are the microwaves you want the superconductor?
Okay, probably they do something, but I guess the main effect is really to do the main effect would be really to drive this microposition dynamics. I think experimentally that's what they show. They put different like materials, and they saw that the main signal comes from the microposition dynamics. It probably heats up a bit the superconductor. It probably excites something, but I guess the main effect should come from.
The frequency is above the superconducting gap. Right.
It is above. So you'll probably excite a bit, but okay, that's one thing. But you could also drive your magnet, just with currents, and then you'll not suffer of that. So that applies to both. If you.
But it might also be interesting because if the frequency is below the gap, then there's like papers by Eddie Asperger and things like from the 70s that where the superconductor is actually enhanced. You can actually enhance the gap of the superconductor by shining microwave to it, which is counterintuitive. But as long as the frequency is below the gap, you just excite the quasi particles above, and then you kind of like effectively cool down the temperature. So that might also be interesting. In this, you can really see maybe the gap increases a bit when you actually shine a microwave.
But you need like strong power, like, or it's.
I don't think it doesn't have to be that strong.
But yeah, obviously, before you make this heterostructure, you first have to somehow characterize what microwaves do to superconductor on its own.
Yeah.
Right? Of course, if something crazy already happens on its own, then you have to maybe get rid of that or somehow utilize it. I don't know. But alternatively, you could just induce magnetic dynamics by current-induced domain of motion type of thing or whatever, and then you don't worry about microwaves. So domain magnetization could move on its own without microwaves in principle, or you have to devise a situation in which microwaves kind of don't do much to the superconductor on its own. And then in the setup, they don't play any role as long as you don't have the kind of effects you're talking about.
And because if you have microwaves which are of the order of the gap or slightly higher, then they really create a lot of trouble.
But again, it's a matter of power, right?
Yeah, well, right, but then I think that people tried to describe it somehow beginning of 80s, and they couldn't come up with anything reasonable. So
yeah.
I think the easiest way to talk yourself out of that is to say, okay, microwaves are the superconductor, not the ferromagnetic
signal. Well, but also go to powers low enough that, at low enough powers, you should not do anything to superconductor. But it will still couple strongly to the ferromagnet. It will still have tiny cone angle that maybe you already will pick up some signal. But that's completely outside of our theory, right? So.
I think we should thank you.
Okay.
Maybe, unless there are urgent questions, go to, I guess, show or?
No, I think it's closed.
Yeah, that's nice.
All right.
Yeah, okay, I'm good.
No, it's not responding. It's coming? It's on the other side. Oh, man. Okay, here we go. Yeah, it works, actually. Okay, yeah. So I'm Koji Sato from... Oh my God, okay, sorry. It was in like slide mode. Okay, full screen. I'm Koji Sato from Tokyo University, and I'm gonna be talking about this electron hole entanglement in a quantum spin hole insulator, two-dimensional topological insulator. And then this work is done with Mircea and Yaroslav. Okay, so let me, before going into the detail, let me like explain the motivations behind this work. So this work is to sort of split the entangled pairs of, in this case, a hole and a particle. But it would be nice to be able to split entangled pair of particles. And then there's this work of a Cooper pair splitter where you take electrons, entangled singlets, spin singlet electrons from a superconductor, and then you hook it up to a solid state system, and then you can split this singlet electrons spatially apart. And then this kind of device would be useful for, let's say, quantum computation, or a test of a Bell's inequality in a solid state device, or quantum cryptography, key distribution, and so forth. So it would be very nice to be able to come up with a device like this. And this is the work done by Daniel a while ago. And this is superconductor connected to quantum dots or Luttinger liquid wires. And in this case, Coulomb blockade helps to split the Cooper pairs. And the Cooper pairs in a superconductor can hop out of the superconductor into different leads. Also, the interaction in the Luttinger liquids supports to split the Cooper pair electrons as well. So these are pretty interesting works to do such work of a Cooper pair splitter. And then surprisingly, we can, this kind of device can be experimentally implemented already. And this is the type of Cooper pair splitter with the quantum dots. And then you can see the signature of Cooper pair splitting into these two different leads.
And those works are done by
these groups. And still, though, even if you split the entangled particles, it's still difficult to see the signature of the entanglement, meaning like normally you probably have to hook up a spin filter or something like that at the end of the leads to see the spins of the incoming particles, but that would be difficult to do. So it would be nice to be able to come up with some scheme to be able to see the entanglement. So that's the motivation. And normally, in order to see the entanglement, we look at this Bell inequality. So I'm just going to briefly go over this thing. So we use this Clauser-Hohn Shimony-Holtz inequality, where this, if the inequality is satisfied, is not satisfied, then there is this quantum effect, quantum entanglement that's going on, and you get some entanglement that cannot be explained by this classical theory. So the violation of this inequality is the signature of the entanglement here. So it's this type of experiment where you have an initially entangled particle, and then they split, and then you detect these two particles separately at two detectors to the left and the right. And then you prepare this spin filter in two locations in front of the detectors. And in order to construct this inequality, you have to prepare four different angles of the spin filters. Namely AB and A prime, B prime, and then construct the correlation between what you detect over here and here in this fashion, and then see whether it's violated or not. And if it's violated, you can tell those two particles were entangled. So we would like to implement such inequality using a quantum spin hole insulator. So for the purpose of the talk, okay, so this is two-dimensional topological insulator with the time reversal invariance. And for the sake of the talk, we'll simply think of the system as on the top edge, we have a spin-up particle moving this way, and then spin-down particle moving to in the opposite direction. And on the other edge, opposite things are going on in this fashion. So we'll think of a quantum spin hole insulator in this fashion. Okay, so this is the type of system that we propose to see an electron hole entanglement in this case. So this is topological insulator here. And we prepare a beam splitter here and here. And also introduce constriction in the middle so that there is going to be inter-edge tunneling. So upper edge particle can tunnel into the lower edge, and also lower edge particle can tunnel into the upper edge. And then beam splitter does the job of this spin filter that I showed you earlier with this EBR experiment. So hopefully it will be clear in the later slides. And in this configuration, amazingly, initially you have incoming non-entangled particles, but through the constriction, you can produce electron hole entangled pair. So that's kind of a surprising result. And
it's not Mach Zehnder. So
what we do is like, okay, we have incoming particle, and then particles tunnel inter edge, and then we measure currents here at these four locations and measure the correlations. So it's not interferometer. And the motivation, yes. Yeah. Okay. In some sense, right. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, right.
Looks pretty much as Mach Zehnder, but I am not so quick to figure out.
Maybe you didn't consider the connection, but perhaps, yeah. So, also, as I told you earlier, like in order to see the signature of the entanglement, we want to look at Bell's inequality.
Let's explain this again a little bit better. So it's really, the left side is like the left side and the optical experiment, right? So the, you know, let's say if you measure, if electron goes into the upper contact on the left, that's like up electron, then down, it's like down electron and particle. And then you measure a correlation between what happens on the left and what happens on the right.
Okay.
So that's one. And then maybe you can, this whole structure is your spin hole ball.
Yeah.
Right?
But so,
maybe gated such that the edges meet and through
yes.
different points.
So yeah, consider like gating in the middle to squeeze the edges so that they come close together to induce the tunneling. So recall that the spin up is going this way and then spin down is going opposite direction. And on the other edge, spin down is going this way and then spin up is going in opposite direction. I'll show you this diagram again to explain this entangled hole. The white line is hole and the black line is electron. And then here's another pair of entangled electron and hole.
It's actually pretty similar to Mach Zehnder with Gordon Hof edge states. You just, because of this opposite chirality, I mean, you kind of add, at every state, you also add another node, which is counter
replicated. Okay.
Yeah, that's symmetric.
Okay. So we'll describe the constriction by this scattering matrix. So A, L and R are incoming state, and B, L and R are outgoing states. So L, incoming states from this way, and then this one, R, is the incoming state from the right-hand side. And then scattered state out of the constriction to the left and to the right. And with the condition on the scattering matrix for unitarity and the time reversal symmetry, we can write the general expression of the scattering matrix in this fashion here.
So how does time reversal symmetry look like? I mean, you reverse the direction and speed same time?
Yeah, also you can, it's yes. So like time reversal operator is.
The H state is a Cramer space. So,
yeah.
You know, it puts things up and down just as a cartoon, but it's a really famous
path. Right, so if you do a time reversal operation, you flip the spin and change the direction of the propagation, right? So you can go through this operation on the scattering matrix and obtain this kind of result in the end. Okay, so using this scattering matrix, so let's say incoming state is, so we biased the left-hand side with respect to the right-hand side. So incoming state has more, so this should be like, EV above actually. So left-hand side is filled up more than the right-hand side. So incoming state, I'm supposed to write this this to be like plus EV. So we have more states on coming from the left end left reservoir. So using a scattering.
I have to interrupt. Some references would really be in place here. So this is just, we're just following the same formalism as developed by Carlo Banneke like about 10 years ago for quantum hole system. So this, that's not our original.
So you have L1 and L2 at the same chemical potential, and R1 and R2 are different, and the difference is equal.
The voltage is applied from left to right.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. And it's basically, it's very similar to the Carlo Bainaga's proposal for the quantum hole with two edge states, except that we have, there things have to be tuned kind of unrealistically to get into maximum entangled state. Here, this
tuning
is provided. It's really important to say that this formula has been developed for quantum hole systems.
Right. So two channel there in the quantum Hall system. So quantum Hall system, we needed two, let's say, Landau levels. But here, we already have two levels for spin up and down. So that would be the analogy here. So for the incoming state, you can rewrite this incoming state with, in terms of the scattering matrix, and then you can obtain this outgoing state. And the outgoing state, so if in a weak tunneling regime, if if no tunneling happens, then spin up particle comes from the left hand side and then comes out here on the right hand side, and then spin down particle comes out and then come out here on the right hand side. So we take most of the states are in this type where spin up is coming to the this reservoir. This detector, and then down is coming to this detector. So we expand the theory with respect to this ground, this state, and then we define this such state as a new ground state, and then we can approximate the outgoing state in this fashion. So this is the newly defined ground state, and this part actually describes the electron and hole pair. So with respect to this new ground state, let's say the top, top particle gets scattered into the lower edge. Then, if no tunneling was to occur, you have field states top and bottom. But if the top one gets scattered and then go into the lower edge, you create a hole on the top, and then you create you have electron coming to the lower edge. So you create this entangled electron and hole pair. And then if the
an electron hole pair.
Yeah,
electron. It's entangled with the
other pair. Entangled with the this pair. Right. Sorry. Yeah. And then likewise, if the lower electron tunnels to the top, it'll create this electron hole. And then these two pairs are entangled. Okay. So as long as we have this outgoing state in this fashion, you can compute the noise. Of the currents that are coming into these four detectors, and you obtain the expression in this fashion using this outgoing state. And then by combining these noise in this fashion, you obtain, let's say, this function. And the role of the beam splitter, as I told you, is some sort of spin filter purpose. So let's say this is some spin rotation, and then you can put the effect of the spin rotation in this fashion here, and then you can recompute this function here. And then in order to construct Bell's inequality, you combine this this function with the this spin filter effect through the beam splitter, and then you can construct the Bell inequality.
Not so much spin filter, just spin rotation.
Spin rotation.
It's already filtered by this edge.
Yeah.
Spin rotation.
Okay. So what we find is that for certain regimes in the parameter space with this beam splitter angles, you can violate the Bell inequality. So you can test the electron hole pair entanglement, and amusingly, we can find this. Maximum of the Bell inequality to be in this fashion, where C is called the concurrence, and C is given by these tau one, tau two, where tau one, tau two are the eigenstates of the T dagger T, where T is the transmission part of the scattering matrix. So in our kind of system with the quantum spin hole insulator, we have T1 equal to T2. So in order to obtain the maximum of C, you need T1 and T2. In general, T1 and T2 means from the top to bottom tunneling, or the top to from bottom to top tunneling. So, transmission, right? Yeah. So there are two channels for the transmission. So in general, that those transmission probability can be different, but in this case, you have the transmission probability to be the same for the two channels. So automatically, we can obtain the maximum concurrence in this kind of system, which is helpful for obtaining the maximum value of the Bell inequality. So it would be easy to see the violation of the Bell inequality here.
Okay.
Yes?
You probably say that it is quantum hole proposal, right? That was the drawback somehow. The edges, one has different, tunnel differently from the other, very different concurrence. It's hard to reach that C equal one.
With the quantum hole, yeah. So the quantum hole system, as I mentioned earlier, you have two channels for the lambda levels, and then those tunneling. So if you have two lambda levels, like the tunneling is pretty sensitive to the location of the lambda level. So if the lambda levels are shifted a little bit, then the tunneling edge states are shifted a little bit, then this tunneling probability is exponentially sensitive. So in this kind of proposal, it might be difficult to achieve the condition for tau 1 equal to tau 2. But in our case, we can automatically have tau 1 equal to tau 2 here, which achieves the
provided by time reversal symmetry.
With the time reversal symmetry. OK. And another thing to mention here is that if we consider electron-electron interaction, we have suppression of the concurrence in this fashion, above some critical temperature. Below the critical temperature, we get some complicated algebraic expression, but this is somewhat intuitive that this thermal noise can smear the entanglement, and then we have reduction of the signature of the entanglement. But as long as C is not zero, you have this B maximum to be violating the Bell inequality. So as long as the concurrence is not zero, you can still see the signature of the entanglement. Although experimentally speaking, the parameter space that you can achieve the violation of Bell's inequality shrinks, basically. So it becomes harder to do the experiment.
But as long as it's not exponentially small.
Right.
It should be fine, right? And generically, in quantum hole systems, it would be exponentially small unless you get very lucky. And here, it's fine as long as temperature is not too high. Temperature is high, then plasma fluctuations make it again exponentially small. Otherwise, at low temperature, it may work out.
All right. So yeah, that's
it.
Okay. Thank you.
References
would have been helpful. Yeah. Yeah, should have.
We have some time for questions.
How small is this step? How small?
So I think we're thinking about using this kind of a mercury telluride well. So I think it's in micron meter size.
How about tunneling distance?
Ah, I see. Right. You mean like a this constriction, right?
Oh, they really have to be touching together, right? Essentially. But that's totally doable, right? Because again, that's the beauty of this quantum spin hole system in principle. You really, the implication here, you really should be able to learn to gate them and define the edge states along the trajectory. That maybe you can also lithographically cut it. Right. Either way, either you can cut it like this, or you can gate it. I think those things will be doable. That's for sure. you know, on the scale of a few years, if not already, people can do this type of things in principle. So in that sense, I think that's kind of our motivation here, is that all the formulas and everything is kind of standard, but I think this system is a really kind of doable experimental. There's nothing crazy, slightly crazy, I would say, here.
I mean, imagine you just fabricated two identical contacts so that you can give it to the maximum entanglement of this 2 square root of 2, but you still need the control parameter.
You don't need identical contacts. You get maximum entanglement already by Tamrosian symmetry. So maximum entanglement is built into our system. Yeah.
Fine. But then you start doing experiments.
This one.
Yeah.
Start doing experiments, and then the result, whether you are below 2 or above 2, depends on the thetas. What is the control parameter for the thetas? So what would you
Oh yeah, for the beam splitter.
Beam splitters, the tunneling. So you have to, along those. So let's first just make one constriction here. So then you produce maximally entangled
every time,
right? And then, so the first proposal that you would have an earlier paper that Koji did inside that didn't have these two constrictions. So then already just, you know, measuring cross correlations from here to here, from here to here, from here to here, even for one constriction is already interesting. It doesn't provide entanglement, but you will see some kind of cross correlations that would somehow reflect this chirality, helicity of this H-state. It will be kind of first experiment to do. Then you make these two new constrictions, and those are your two knots that would be analogous to rotating your polarizing optical experiment. So as you're changing these two knots, you know, you modify your cross correlations.
Like putting a gate and something.
Putting a gate, or it could be anything, right? So maybe first you have to bring them close together such that you have tunneling across. And then the knob could be at the gate or some local magnetic field, or whatever that will modify the standard.
How does gating help you around the wall? Because you did.
Oh, that's a QPC.
What?
That's a quantum property.
Remember, this is not a semiconductor that has a gap. There's no gap here. So it's like shift the surface state around.
It's all insulated except for these two H states. And then
you talked about. So I have insulator here. And then you're trying to gate it to pinch those off together. But gating doesn't.
But the overlap will go. You want to bring the edge states together, right? Gating will change the overlap.
Because if there's some external electrostatic component potential, you can modify it.
Right. And you could either use electrostatic potential or some magnetic field. Because it will also change the
overlap.
It
probably makes things more
complicated.
Yeah, but whichever.
Yeah, time reversal symmetry is broken.
Another thing is that the beam splitter should be long enough so that you don't bring the
back. Yeah, backscattering.
Yeah,
but
it has to be long enough. Right.
Any more points to this question?
All right, thank you.
Just a brief remark, there will be another hike on Saturday and yoga on Sunday, right?
Well, still seeing a little bit. Anybody interested? Any takers? Going to the house now. Will you use 5:30 yoga? The yoga soon?
5:30 in the morning?
Okay. That was a quick comment while Bert is looking at his computer. We're not really serious about a bell test in our proposal. We don't wanna, a good bell test, yeah, is not possible. We're not going to do a bell test as good as the OTP. Everything is going to be never all so close together. It will be, you know, some crosstalks, runs or whatever, there's not enough theory, there's so many loopholes. It's not really a matter of like realizing all that. It's more like building up this quantum correlations, which only consistent was a bell test, but not a bell test in a perfect sense.
Very often
the experiments in the next building outside cannot play anymore.
it would not be. Yeah, and I think in solid state you will never do a good Bell test.
No, I have done good Bell test. But okay, but it's with qubits and then.
There's always loophole because everything's so close together. Yeah. Optical Bell test are the best, and you can never do those. But as a resource of some kind of quantum computing, that's kind of what
you're saying. Yeah, you don't want to kind of quantum computer, which is.
That's right.
Okay, good. Well, in order to make my role as semi-experimentalist of the week a bit more active, I volunteered in also presenting a pitch, which is on a completely different topic than what I discussed on Wednesday. But it's very strongly related to what you have been discussing over the past weeks, probably, and which was also nicely, very nicely introduced yesterday by Mark. So that is probably helpful for the ones who are less familiar with the kind of things I will be discussing. This partly reflecting on some work we published earlier this year and some work which has been done since then. And I should acknowledge this particular PhD student, Jeroen Franken and Henk Zwachten, whom you know all. So this is all about current-induced domain motion in perpendicular magnetic anisotropic materials and a story about spin hole effects and Dijon-Lozinski-Marie interactions. So it starts, and that was already introduced yesterday. If you have a current in a bilayer, have platinum here, you pump on orthogonal spins upwards. If you now have a domain wall stripe on top, and the domain wall stripes we are investigating usually are so wide that the ground state is a block state, you see that the spins you pump in are parallel to the states in the domain wall, and thereby there is no torque on those spins and there won't be any domain wall motion. Now, you can of course get rid of this by applying an in-plane field, like also addressed already before. In that case, you do get a finite torque on the wall and finite domain wall motion. But you're also helped by the Dijon-Lozinski-Marie interaction in a very nice way, and that will also be clear from the next slides. And this is the picture. I have the naive picture of domain wall motion, kind of inspired by the picture of Stewart of having induced moments. And those induced orbital moments, you can think of gears. And if you have two domains, they rotate in in the opposite direction, and thereby they can drive a gear in the domain wall, orbital currents in the domain wall, which are coupled again to the spins, and thereby pin the domain wall in the nail state. And of course, you can also see if I make a symmetric structure, this thing gets stuck because then there are two opposite forces to the central gear in the domain wall. Okay, so thereby you can set the nail state and thereby you can have a domain wall motion. Now, what we investigated is platinum-cobalt-platinum structures. And initially, you may be inclined to say that there is no net effect because I spin, for instance, spins pointing out of the blackboard upward but pointing into the blackboard downward from the top layer. But of course, this symmetry is broken if I have two layers which have a different thickness. And in that case, well, depending on how you, as soon as one of the layers is thinner than the spin diffusion length,
why don't you just cope out something else? I guess. Why don't you make it more symmetric, which is a different
thing? I think it is interesting for various. First of all, you want to understand this. Secondly, I think you have a very nice handle on the length scales involved. Because, I mean, you can very nicely, elegantly see, basically, at which thickness you start to have these kind of spin hole effects. So I think from that point of view, it's a very nice analytical tool also.
But if you replace one of the platinum with copper,
For sure. I mean, yeah.
But yeah. Maybe in some case you may get into some kind of counterintuitive situation in which did you get into any counterintuitive situation in which you do use two platinum, but the effect is somehow still stronger than in copper platinum? Is that possible? Or?
Well, I come with some whether it's counterintuitive, but I come with some interesting results anyway. And of course, I mean, one other reason why we went into it is that we already for a couple of years wanted to study spin transfer torque induced domain wall motion in platinum, cobalt, platinum. And as you know, there were very unexpected results. And the one group found that the domain walls moved in the one direction with the electron flow, opposite to the electron flow. In the end, this is just the answer. So you wanted to clarify that picture. But I think there's more interest than that.
Mostly varied from like noise
yes.
back,
yes.
Some
yes.
small
impact. Yes,
back.
Yes, yes. Okay, so. What we have been doing is experiments on measuring this by current-induced deepening of domain walls, and one of our working horses there is the focused ion beam irradiation. We used it in many different schemes. This is the most simple one. Here you see a microscope image, current microscopy, of a wire of typically a micrometer wide. And one segment is irradiated by a focused ion beam, thereby slightly reducing the anisotropy. If you now apply a reverse field, it's very easy in a controllable way here to nucleate a reverse domain. And if you now increase the reversed field, and you looked in your magneto-optical Kerr microscope, at some point you see depending here of the rightmost domain wall, and at a slightly higher field, you also see that the left domain is deepened. And you can nicely measure this now, which current and which field, etc., is needed to get a deepening. Now, just one slide to give you a flavor of how the measurements go. So here we have our stripe. We are focusing on this domain wall. We apply an in-plane field, thereby set the nail state to the left. And we do a deepening experiment, and we carefully measure. And we measure that we need, if we have no current, we need about 10.3 millitesla to deepen the domain wall. So that's the field in the perpendicular direction. And I should also emphasize that, of course, if I apply a field in the upper direction, there will be a tendency for this domain wall to move to the right and for this domain wall to move to the left, just to expand the central domain. Now you can apply a positive current, and you see that you need less perpendicular field. You can apply a negative current, and you need a stronger field to deepen. And this sets the efficiency for current-induced deepening, and that will be called epsilon, somewhere that will appear. The slope is epsilon. Now, you can also do the same experiment for the left domain wall, and you will find actually the same efficiency. And what this actually means is that this current tries to push this domain wall to the right, whereas it tries to push this domain wall to the left. So that means that this effect is field-like in the sense that it has the same effect as a perpendicular field. But of course, it's not field-like in the terminology of field-like and damping-like, because we are here considering damping-like torques. Okay, now you can repeat the experiment. You can do it as a function of in-plane field. And you see that the effect is kind of linear in the in-plane field. But as soon as you are above 50 millitesla, the thing stabilizes. And you can reproduce this also by micromagnetic simulation. And you find that indeed you need approximately a field of 10 to 20 millitesla to drive the system from the block state to the nail state. And once the system in the nail state, basically it doesn't help anymore, providing a larger in-plane field. Now the cute thing is that you can, and you see you have the same effect basically for the left and the right domain wall. You can now grow different structures. And here's where the symmetry comes in. This was a structure where the bottom platinum was 4 nanometer and the top platinum was 2 nanometer. Here you have 3-3, and there's no effect at all. And here you have 2-4, and you see the reverse effect. So it's exactly consistent with a spin Hall effect, where basically one of the two layers is thinner than the spin diffusion length. This is not all the data. You can, of course, play around more with thicknesses, and you can even also derive then the spin diffusion length. And what we find is actually that two bunches of parameters found in literature, we find the small spin diffusion length and the spin hole angle of around 0.07.
And the Wilshinsky-Maurer interaction is present in all these three cases.
That's the next thing I want to address. You might wonder, is there also a Wilshinsky-Maurer interaction? In this case, you would say no. Based on these results, you would say it is not. So basically, yes. Before I get to that, just one other thing which puzzled me for some time, but maybe for you it's very clear why that is. You can compare our results on depending efficiency as a function of in-plane field with, for instance, Stuart Parkin's result, domain of velocity, as an applied in-plane field. And then what might be surprising is the fact that we found this strong saturation effect applying only 10 millitesla, whereas in this case the velocity is still completely, almost completely linear as a function of in-plane field. Ah, yes, this was an animation. This is not real. probably he's watching the hi, Stuart.
It's not live, unfortunately.
Sorry?
It's not live. Okay, but what's the difference between the structures?
Well, the one thing which is different is this is cobalt, more complicated, so cobalt, nickel, etc., with a larger asymmetry. But that's not the point. What the point actually is, sorry for the bad image here, it has to do with the completely different regime in current densities. In our case, we apply relatively small current densities, and then the current and the spin Hall effect has no direct effect on the domain wall state. If you go to higher current densities, then you'll find that this pumping of this orthogonal spins really drives, stabilizes the Bloch state itself. And you can do it just from a simple one-dimensional model. And indeed, And you'll find that in this case, indeed, if you take exactly the same parameters, you do the experiment for a much stronger current, then you see that you need a much larger field to rotate the spins away from the Bloch direction. So, of course, the advantage of going to higher current densities is velocities are higher, etc. But there is a disadvantage that you need to apply a larger field to take care that the spins indeed go in the optimal direction. So I just thought it was good to mention this, because if you see the two data, you say that those are not compatible. Why is it? Well, this is the result. Okay. Then the DMI. And, well, of course, we also did the experiment putting aluminum oxide at the other side. And, of course, then you have a strong DMI. And you immediately see it, because in this case, actually, you see that the efficiency is in the field range of in-plane fields we can apply in our magneto-optical current microscope. The efficiency is completely independent of the in-plane field. And moreover, you see that the right and the left domain wall have opposite efficiencies. So now they tend to move coherently. And it's clear that this is due to the DMI. And DMI, obviously, the field associated to the DMI is much larger than the maximum field in our experiment. Okay, now, motivated by that, we redid a lot of these experiments and now try to see whether in these structures, because if you look here more carefully, of course, when we published this work, we were not aware that much of this DMI effect. But you see that there might be actually a small difference here. And actually, if you repeatedly grow these samples and now also working with thinner, even thinner ones, you see that really by tuning now the top layer, you can tune this opening here. And this opening in this here is just a DMI field. The slope here has to do with the anisotropy field, so the stabilizing field for the Bloch domain wall. And the shift, the opening here, is a very fine measure of the DMI. And again, aluminum oxide has a very large DMI, much larger than what we measure here. And you could say, most surprisingly, in 1 nanometer, you have a decent DMI of around 30 millitesla. But even with 2 nanometer and 4 nanometer, there's still a finite DMI. And in a sense, that is interesting, because you might think that DMI is related, like we heard yesterday, related to the Rushbaugh effect, really an interface effect. So basically, the fact that with 2 nanometer here at the top and 4 nanometer at the bottom, you have DMI for an ideal system would be surprising.
And it's smaller, but it's basically roughly just as strong. The ballpark of DMI is just as strong.
Well, of course, you have, I mean, there is DMI, but DMI on itself is extremely strong, of the order of a tesla. I mean, if you take the optimal structure, it gets close to a tesla. So we find a finer DMI, but you should not think that you have the full DMI here.
A finite net DMI,
yeah. So no, of course, no. At the bottom and the top, there will be a the full DMI, but now, of course, there's a strong cancellation, and what is left over is...
So compare the left to the right. How much stronger the DMI is on the right?
Well, the right we couldn't measure, but if you go to the data, for instance, of Parkin, you see that it's a few tenths of a tesla. So it's in between 1 and 2 two orders.
Okay.
So those are, this is my last slide, and those are, apart from just a pretty picture of our yesterday's discussion, I want to just throw in some considerations and ask you to reflect. This is the first point. So basically, note that the effects are very significant, but just 1 to 10% of the full DMI. So it's the two are almost comparable, but not really. Now, there's two possible explanations, of course. The one would be maybe most interesting, that it turns out that there really is, for an ideal system, which you could maybe calculate for or make, that there is indeed a difference, and then you get more information about the DMI and length scales, etc. itself. Maybe even about the mechanisms. What is the exact origin of the DMI? If induced moments, which is one of the claims, are involved, how perfectly do they converge once you are at a range of 1 or 2 nanometer, etc. So all kind of questions you might be addressing if the systems would be ideal. But of course, we also know that these systems are not
ideal.
Far from ideal. I mean, you even have to think about the way that they're produced by UHV sputtering. And you produce layers of 0.5, 0.6 nanometers of cobalt. So even if there would be only a monolayer into the fusion, then it is already, I mean, it is more like an alloy than a discrete multilayer. So there's intermixing.
There's aluminum oxide, thermal yep. and platinum in that type of setup.
Yes.
Change thickness of platinum. That's what we kind of
clean and No, but yeah, you could say, but basically then you have a very large effect and you are going to change that a little bit. And I think that is, and then you have to grow different samples, and any irreproducibility in the samples make it go. The nice thing here is that you do a differential experiment.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think it's difficult to pick up the same small effects if you would measure the full DMI. Of course, there's another thing that growing platinum top of cobalt is a different process than cobalt on top of platinum. And okay, well, there are all kind of. Yesterday I had a very nice introduction discussion with Kyung Yin and Yun Wu about that was different systems. But were also oxidations, in that case through magnesium oxide, changed effects in a subtle way. So, I mean, everything could go wrong, of course. Right. But
so you have a 3 nanometer sample, and it still shows DMI. Is that?
That I cannot say because there's no spin hole effect, so we have no spin hole effect induced deepening.
So you don't say it, because you might see that leftovers in the whole effect as well.
Yes, yeah. No, but for rest, I mean, any combination where we do have a finite spin orbit torque, we could measure the DMI.
But not through, it's just...
If the spin orbit torque is vanishingly small, then of course it's difficult
and
to measure.
And it is vanishingly small for 3.3 nanometers.
So like I showed, yes.
It's more or less
symmetric. Yeah. So you could say that at least tells that the two interfaces are rather comparable, yeah. Because otherwise it would probably also vanish somewhere, but not exactly for 3.3.
Yeah.
But of course, the difference is that this spin hole effect, of course, is more bulk-like.
Nobody knows.
But the data we do have seem to indicate that indeed, over the range of a few nanometer, it is well tunable, and something like a spin diffusion length, whatever the meaning is, may play a role.
Which is what, couple nanometers in the
case? No. What we measure, what I say, is like 1.5 or so. So a smaller value than you would expect.
Everybody gets something like one.
I think that there's this. Everyone who measures for platinum a spin hole angle of around 0.07 gets a very small spin diffusion length. Whatever that may mean.
Yeah.
But everybody who measures spin diffusion length using a different technique gets a longer.
Yes. Yes.
But these are usually different systems, so it's very simple.
That could. Yeah.
There has been now this. There was a comment by Jack Bass, who puts all the different class, data mm-hmm. on top.
Yeah.
And he finds a nice linear relation between the resistivity and the spin filament.
Yes, but resistivity of scope when you spin.
Yes.
Yeah.
In but these systems, you don't know what the resistivity is.
Yeah, it's what it is.
Because you have a cobalt layer on top of it. So you can't measure it independently of
And if you think it's dominated by surface scattering, surface.
Yeah.
Well, I would, okay, no, I think, to be honest, I think, you could do this if you put it on Ying, for example. There, it's just a plant.
Do we have a good way to characterize the interface?
Yes.
So, for example, when we have 3-nanometer platinum and another 3-nanometer platinum, I assume that these two interfaces cannot be the same.
Yes.
So it may generate a finite DMI.
Yes.
So it may be very important to characterize these two interfaces. Is
yes.
it possible to do that in experiment?
Well, I have been thinking recently. Well, it may be very subtle effects which are very hard to measure. I mean, something which I recently came to, of course, in a group in Eindhoven, we have been doing and still doing solid state NMR, which for epitaxial films is a unique way of measuring interface roughness. How far we can push it in these systems, which are already more disordered from nature, I don't know. But that would that might be an interesting study, because the solid state NMR on cobalt just gives you the distribution of coordinations of the cobalt atoms. So if you, for instance, if you have a 1-1-1 surface and have an ideal epitaxial system, then you just see a bulk peak and a peak with 9 cobalt neighbors. As soon as you get into the fusion, you also see peaks arising at 10 and 11 and 8, etc. Now, that works extremely fine if you have epitaxial films. Here it will be much worse, but maybe by doing a differential measurement, by taking the cobalt spectrum for the one interface and for the reversed interface, maybe you get some information. But we didn't do that experiment yet.
One question.
Yes.
Can you measure the magnitude of field electron from the experiment?
We played around also with in-plane fields, etc. And in general, we find a immeasurably small effect. I mean, I cannot say that it's really not there, but I mean, we were not able to.
If it was the same order of magnitude, the same, but
same. Yeah, then we pick it up, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you think it's at least 10
not 10 orders, but 1 order.
Yes,
yeah.
You don't need any other torques, right? You only do to explain a very bad.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
Only
yes. Of course, in a sense, you could say if there would be a Rushbach torque, there would also be a strong tendency for canceling. So basically, whether the individual interface doesn't have a Rushbach contribution, I mean, is then it should appear from the aluminum oxide, but then you also compete a much stronger spin Hall effect torque.
In your measurement, I assume that you measure the field light torque in the case where magnetization is almost in the perpendicular direction. Am I right?
Sorry, say it again.
So you measure the field light torque by applying very small field, and then magnetization is almost pointing in that direction. People usually do that.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes. Yeah.
But the spin tech results show that here field light is small.
Yeah.
Here field light is big. If we
yeah.
So it's not really field light. It's much more complicated.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah.
So it would be worthwhile doing the measurement by applying. Higher field.
Yeah. Okay. Well, certainly, there's more we can do in that direction.
What's the point? So, in experiments, so how did you tune the domain structure from near to block?
That's in the first experiment. It was just by applying an in-plane field. So basically, you start at zero in-plane field. This is domain wall structure. And you apply in-plane field, and you will see just linearly the domain wall will tilt, and the anisotropy field stabilizing the block state is about 15 millitesla. So if you apply more than 15 millitesla, it is really in this configuration. But this is if there is no Dzhousinski-Murie interaction, because if that is there, then it adds up, and then you get the sum of the two, and that
net
is no nets.
So this fields are small enough to not have any significant effect on the domains itself.
You mean whether they can't? At some point, and I have to think, because there is certainly something. For these small fields, it's not a series. But let me the PhD students on top of this, they did a lot of simulations. Also, what that effect has. Oh, specifically when we are doing domain world, I did show that we do also actually that's other new data. And I see, since I have 2 minutes time.
Intelligence and Maria interaction is not going to lead to cancer. Yeah. It's going to lead to a chiral ground state or
This is other set of data, basically, where we do domain wall resistance measurements in a differential way. Also, to have an independent way of measuring that we have a transition from Bloch to Néel. I mean, it will be too time-consuming to explain everything. But then, indeed, you'll get sometimes some background because you also start to cant the magnetization in the domains, and that gives you some AMR or whatever. And so that is something which is in taken into account in our considerations, and certainly not affecting the previous data.
Have you tried other materials and other environments? So I guess the kind of the story pitching is that platinum is really special because of
perhaps proximity. Not in a systematic way, no.
Okay.
No.
Only in platinum. But Stuart has done that.
He's just sees it decaying. I mean, I think gold is absent, or kind of absent, and then he has two other materials where it's increasing gradually. I have the paper. I can look it up. Some time ago that I read it.
Any more questions?